Right. Well, welcome back. We just came back from break, and we're taking a look in the previous module at Azure Websites, which are a super powerful platform as a service, you know, execution or compute model that we have up on Azure. In this module, we're going to come back in and talk about cloud services, which has actually had a number of names as it's gone through its lifetime here on Azure. We had them as hosted services back in the day, and we'll see in the next module that the cloud service part of cloud services are actually exactly the same cloud service that we'll talk about with virtual machines as well. Really, what's special about cloud services here, though, is the kinds of workloads we run in this cloud service. And we'll talk about web roles and worker roles and what we use them for and all that good stuff. So we're going to start out looking at cloud services architecture, really sort of get big picture. We'll talk about, you know, how is it that it's different than websites and virtual machines and that kind of stuff. And we'll come back in and look at the development model around building web roles and worker roles. Then we'll see once you've developed them. And there's a really cool compute and storage emulator that you get with the Azure SDK that lets you actually develop cloud services on your own dev machine without necessarily even having to have an Azure account.
Yeah.
You can actually do those without really any Azure piece, so to speak. But at some point, you've got to get it out of development and up into the production environment. And you could use some of those same continuous deployment techniques and things like that we sort of covered in websites. I'm not going to get into them here, but similar techniques can be used there as well. And then we'll wrap up once they're running, how do you get in and look at them and monitor them and all that good stuff. So I've got a lot of slides because I tend to be a very visual talker. So I got to try and stay on track here and make sure that I don't push us over on time. But let me jump in and take a look at cloud services architecture. And again, I said that this was the original compute model that we had up in Azure. So when Azure first came out, it was very platform as a service centric. And as a developer, for me, platform as a service is the way to go. I don't necessarily want to have to be responsible for managing the virtual machines and the operating systems and the service packs and the hotfixes and the security and the drive configurations and registry settings and all that kind of stuff inside my compute environment if I don't have to. If you're in an environment where those are a part of your current deployment model, it's nice to have the virtual machine capabilities that we have up in Azure. But if you're building new solutions where you can sort of break that dependency on the physical configuration of the computing environment itself, man, platform as a service is the way to go. And in Azure, you really have, you know, our cloud services, websites, mobile services is another really cool platform as a service story that we have that lets you run code without necessarily having to get into the nitty-gritty of the underlying compute environment here.
Yeah, so, remember that entire speech because you're going to be using that same speech when you're talking to your IT pros in the shop about cloud services. You're going to come to love it as much as we do. And there's a lot of scenarios. Some of the customizations Brett talked about, you can actually still do in cloud services with startup tasks and things like that. But it's always an uphill battle talking to IT pros saying, hey, yeah, we want a VM, but we don't want to manage it.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, somewhere underneath, there's still an OS running. It's just how much responsibility do you have to configure and maintain and manage that operating system, right? So, in fact, with that said, I've got a slide here that really sort of compares websites that we just took a look at, cloud services we'll take a look at in this module, and then virtual machines that we'll come back and talk about in the next module. And so if you think about how much control you have over that compute environment, you probably have the least amount of control with websites. Now, we saw that Kudu, you know, debug console, but you wouldn't normally think about going in and using that as a way of setting registry settings or things like that. It's there, but that's really not its intended purpose there. With cloud services, though, you are closer to the virtual machine. Websites, I tend to think of as almost like IIS as a service. You know, you really should, you don't want to be thinking about configuring the VM itself. You're going to hurt yourself if you get to that level. With cloud services, there is a VM. We just manage it for you, but we give you, as Sydney mentioned, you know, some startup tasks or some other configurations that you can do to somewhat sort of massage, if you will, that virtual machine environment. And then you go to virtual machines, where it's just a VM. Get in and do whatever the heck you want to do. So you've got full control. So cloud services, just kind of in between websites and virtual machines. Legacy app support with virtual machines, you got full support. It's a Windows box. You go stick whatever you want to on it and just run it. Websites, you have legacy app support in the sense of that you can run ASP.NET websites on it, but you're not going to run, you know, a VB UI based application inside an Azure website. That's just not what it's meant for. Again, cloud services are kind of between the two. Yes, you can run some kinds of legacy apps, but we'll see here that cloud services are stateless, or at least web roles and worker roles are stateless. And so if you have stateful applications, they don't necessarily work well in a cloud service or web role, worker role environment. As you look at ease of management, though, those bars flip. Websites are the easiest to manage because you have fewer things that you're responsible for managing. And so with that, lack of control becomes this increased manageability because you're not having to go in and set as many things. On the other inverse, virtual machines aren't as easy only because there's more things that you may have to do. You can do them, but you have to do it. So that kind of lowers that bar. And then lastly, agility. With ease of management comes this ability to do things like scaling, distributing it across data centers. So you mentioned Traffic Manager and things like that. It makes it very easy for me to set up the same execution model with websites or cloud services across data centers, whereas virtual machines makes it a little more difficult. I got to get my images distributed and all that kind of stuff with virtual machines.
So before you move on, Brett, if we could jump back to that slide real quick. We had two questions come up in the chat. The first one was around websites. One question I can think of. First one's around websites, cloud services, virtual machines. Talking about that platform as a service, infrastructure as a service, and software as a service model. Used to be clearly defined where you could say websites was software as a service and cloud services was platform as a service and virtual machines was infrastructure as a service. But we're starting to find a blurring of the lines lately. And Brett could probably talk to this a whole lot, but websites is almost platform as a service at this point.
Yeah.
It's expanded so much.
Well, and I personally never called websites SaaS or software as a service. The way I've always sort of differentiated SaaS from PaaS is if an end user can sign up for it, it's SaaS. If a developer signs up for it, it's PaaS, right?
Yeah.
Software as a service is meant for non-developer audiences to go out and consume a pre-developed application. And yes, websites, you had templates like WordPress blogs and things like that, but I had to go through an Azure management portal with a very developer-y mindset really to get to that point. Versus, say, Office 365, I could have my administrative assistant who has no technical abilities, I don't mean that right or wrong, be able to go sign up for that service, right? They don't have to be a technical expert to sign up for a SaaS-type service.
Right. So,
anyhow, but yeah, I view websites and cloud services as PaaS solutions and virtual machines as IaaS. All right, so what is a cloud service? Well, a cloud service is really this protective boundary around a collection of virtual machines. And for this module, we'll talk about those virtual machines being either web role instances or worker role instances. That same cloud service boundary, though, is what could also encompass your virtual machine instances that we'll talk about in the next module. So a web role is really a template for a pre-configured Windows server. You can choose your OS family anywhere from Server 2008 up to Server 2012 R2. You get IIS pre-installed on these guys, so you don't have to go set it up, and as well as endpoints and firewall rules to allow web traffic into these virtual machines so that you don't have to go manage the firewalls. And pretty much anything that you would run on IIS, you could run inside a web role. They're customizable with startup scripts. You can code, all that kind of stuff, and we'll come back and see that. Worker roles are really intended more for the non-IIS type workloads. So if you go back and think about your own data centers, what are the things that you run on Windows boxes, not in IIS? Those are the kinds of workloads that you could run inside of a worker role. We tend in general, I think, to think of them as more sort of background processing or, you know, queue readers and that kind of stuff. But you could conceivably write a startup script that installed Apache, opened up port 80, and have Apache running on a worker role if you wanted to, right? They're pretty customizable. I don't want to have to do that if I don't have to, right? But it's available to you if you need to. All right, so role is really sort of the template versus the instance is the actual running virtual machine.
Right.
So a role is really a template for a virtual machine. It's going to have the configuration, what's the operating system, how big, how powerful should the VM be, what's the endpoints for the network firewall configuration, other settings that you need during runtime and things like that. That's all part of that metadata in the configuration. And then the other thing that goes along with a role is the code that you want to actually run on it. And from Visual Studio, from the Azure SDK, when you package your code up, you effectively get a zip file that has your configuration, your code output, and all that kind of stuff that we can ship up to the data center and run on it. And so when the data center gets that, it's going to go spin up an instance. That's an actual running copy of that role, with the right OS, with the right endpoint set up, with the configuration and settings applied, and with your code now deployed onto that instance and running. So it takes care of spinning up the instance. It takes care of configuring it for you based on your metadata that you shipped up, and then deploying your code, and then it monitors that for you. And so the cool thing about that is that now that you have this template, you can spin up multiple copies of that. In fact, we'd recommend that you have at least two instances of any role running just to help manage the service level agreements and load balancing and fault tolerance and all that other kind of stuff out there.
So Brett's a technical evangelist. I'm actually consulting out in the field, so I deal with customers yelling at me daily. Really clear to you developers, because I have to say it to IT pros too. If you do not have two instances, this is for virtual machines, an availability set or two instances of your role, you do not meet the SLA.
Yep. Yeah, so you need two for the SLA. Yep. That's the service level agreement where we'll give you a financially backed compensation should we do something that causes your instances to go down.
I hate for your instances to go down and you not get a check in the mail. That would hurt.
Yep. So, and now on the slide there, you can see that endpoint, that those arrows coming into my instance. That's my incoming firewall rules, if you will. If they're load balanced, they're also automatically managed for me. So I can now scale up and add additional instances. Sydney talked about auto scale for websites. You can do auto scale for cloud services as well, or manual scale. You can just manually come in and slide up the number of instances for a role. And that's going to give you, again, improved performance and fault tolerance. And again, everything's just managed for you. You move the slider, it spins the VMs up, it configures them, it deploys your code. You don't have to mess with that stuff. And you can also, of course, scale back down as demand decreases, have it auto scale or manually scale back down. So those compute web and worker role virtual machine instances are pre-configured for you. Again, you pick the OS. You get you don't have to install the OS, though. You don't have to maintain the OS. You just give us the code and the configuration. We take care of it. The key thing that you need to realize with these guys, and this is going to be the biggest difference for you between platform as a service and infrastructure as a service virtual machines, is that these VMs are stateless. Meaning that while they're running, if there's anything that you were to write to the hard drive storage on that virtual machine itself, at some point that VM is going to be recycled. It's going to go through an upgrade process, or it's going to crash and have to be moved to another rack or something like that. When that happens, we're not going to send somebody over to recover the data. We're just going to discard it, spin up a fresh copy somewhere else, redeploy your configuration, and redeploy your code.
So that's where your startup scripts become critical. It's important that you make sure in your startup script that you're installing everything your application needs. And this leads perfectly into a question we have from the chat room that I want to throw at you. They have a CMS called Kintia. They run installation.exe. If you need to run installation.exe for a cloud service, I'm gonna let you answer, Brett. But I already, we both know. But how would you do that?
Well, you can. There's a number of ways. First of all, when your VM instance starts up. So first of all, remember you could most likely, in fact, desirably have two instances of that spinning up. So I need both of those virtual machines to be able to get to that installation media. And so I either need to include that installation media as part of the zip file that I ship up to the Azure Data Center, or probably better yet, I stick them off into blob storage, or maybe now into an Azure File Share or something like that, or maybe I download them through, say, Web Platform Installer or something like that. And then what I do is I include along with that a script, a batch file or PowerShell script or something like that, and I can set up in my configuration what's called a startup script. I give it a task. Most installations, especially for like a CMS, are probably going to need to run with elevated permissions. So they run with admin privileges, and then you basically say, go get that exe, run the install, pass in any command line switches and things like that. But that's another key point, is any of those installations need to be scriptable. if you have some weird, funky tool you have to install that requires manual config, maybe this isn't the right model for you, and that's when you fail back to IaaS, right? So I always say, going through that model of websites versus cloud services, virtual machines, the answer is websites.
Yeah.
Until it's not. Until there's something you can't do in websites, then you step down to the next level. And then the answer is cloud services with web roles and worker roles. Until it's not.
Yeah.
Until there's something you can't do, and you have to then step down to IaaS, right? And so not that IaaS is bad, it's just for me, it's the last resort, because I'd much rather not have to have that degree of configuration. All right, so these things are stateless. Remember I said they're stateless. Remember I said they're stateless. So if you embrace stateless, you will love PaaS. If you build your applications so that you're not dependent on the resources that are on the physical machine, you instead keep your resources where you can get to them from anywhere, PaaS is beautiful, right? It's when you're bound to, I had to have that file in the C drive temp directory or something like that, that then PaaS becomes a little more painful. All right, so let's look at that another way, right? Inside the Azure Data Center, we've got this, you know, collection of physical servers and on those, racks, and on those racks are servers, and on those servers are the virtual machines that we run and all that kind of stuff. And there's a piece of software that runs in the data center called the Fabric Controller, and it's responsible for managing all those resources and spinning up your VMs and configuring the networks and deploying your code and monitoring them and all that good stuff. And then adjacent to those racks in those same data centers are our storage services, tables and queues and blocks and Azure SQL databases, and we'll come back and talk about those later on as well. But if I spin up, a web role instance, and while that web role is running, I write things to the VM itself, let's say a local resource, which you can do. If that VM crashes, like I said, we're not going to send somebody over to recover data off that. We're simply going to discard that virtual machine, and it goes away, right? So now the Fabric Controller can come in and spin up a fresh copy, and if while that fresh copy is running, you instead wrote all your data off into your storage services, so that's where your data is, then I now have the ability to, when that VM crashes, not care. It's okay to discard it because I didn't lose my data. I can spin up a fresh copy somewhere else and still get to all my data. Plus, I now have the ability to scale up and have any number of instances getting access to that same data on the back end. So as long as you keep your data off the VM, you keep your VM stateless, PaaS is beautiful. All right, so inside your Azure data center, we have this thing called a cloud service. This is the protective boundary around your virtual machine instances. And the cloud services is where your fully qualified domain name, your cloud service name, .cloudapp.net name is going to be bound to. And you get that cloudapp.net name for free, but you can also put custom domain names. You'll host your DNS somewhere else. But you configure your DNS zones with some CNAMEs and things like that to point into this if you want to put custom domain names in front of that. Your cloud service also comes with a firewall and a load balancer sitting in front of it, and that's going to protect and distribute connections coming in from the outside world. And so into that cloud service, you can run either the persistent virtual machines that we'll talk about in the next module, or you can run and open up, let's say, endpoints that allow inbound connections. So normally I wouldn't recommend, let's say this virtual machine was running SQL Server. We don't normally open up port 1433 in to your SQL Server instances, but if you needed to, you could do that. I could open up what's called an instance input endpoint that allowed a direct port 1433 connection into my virtual machine. Now remember that, in fact, Sydney and I were talking about this earlier. Remember that VM is Windows, and Windows has its own firewall in it.
Yep.
So you also have to go in and configure the Windows firewall, but that's nothing different than if you were running on-prem, right? You still have to manage your firewall rules to allow inbound traffic. But now you could also have web roles. Those web roles could also have incoming what we call input endpoints that are load balanced. And that means that I could now spin up additional instances of that web role, and that load balanced input endpoint is going to be automatically distributed across them. Similarly, worker roles, you can also open up input endpoints, although they don't come with one for free. Well, not for free, but out of the box, you can always add some in more if you need to, and they can also be load balanced. But you can also open up what are called internal endpoints. Tend to recommend against this, but if you're opening up, let's say, some proprietary service and you want to be able to connect to it from the other roles in the same cloud service, you can do that. Input endpoints are different because they're dynamic. You don't know how many instances there are. You don't know what ports they're going to be listening on. You don't know what their IP addresses are. So they're all going to be discoverable through the service runtime metadata. I can, when my code's running, say, hey, Azure, What are all the instances of this role, and what are the endpoints on that instance? So I can now discover them programmatically. Each role instance could have its own input or endpoint opened up. I could discover them and allow connections coming in from the other role instances in that cloud service. And then, of course, behind that, we have all the other Azure goodness, storage services, Azure SQL Database, media streaming, Traffic Manager, Active Directory, all these other services that we can gain access to from those cloud services. All right, so let me jump over to the portal here. And I've got, as Sydney had, I have my development environment just happens to also be a virtual machine running in Azure, but that's coincidental. This is just an Azure or Windows box with Visual Studio and stuff installed on it. But I've got the management portal open. And if I come down to cloud services, you'll see that I actually have two cloud services already in place. I can create a new cloud service pretty easily if I just click on the new button and jump over to compute and cloud service, and I'll do a quick create. And I can give it a name. I'll just call it my MVA 532. How about CS for cloud service? .cloudapp.net. And that does have to be a good, valid, unique host name. And the green check mark there is letting me know nobody else is using it and it's a valid name. And then I can pick the data center where I want this cloud service to run. And we're out in Seattle, so I'll pick West US. And then I can just hit create cloud service. Now at this point, all I'm really creating is that boundary. I haven't told it what workloads to run inside that cloud service at all, right? So that's gonna be, we'll come back and look at development following up there. But that'll take a little bit of time to build. Shouldn't take too long though, because it doesn't actually have to go spin up. Oh, actually it's already done. So it's already done, so it's created it. And again, if I go into it, there's really nothing there. If I go to instances, I don't have anything deployed into this environment. I built the container, but I haven't put anything into it yet. There were also some discussions about the new portal or the preview portal versus the current portal, et cetera. Cloud services and web role and worker roles are one of the things that you still have to use the current portal for. They're not yet supported in the preview portal.
You can always just use PowerShell.
Yeah, or script it. Yeah, what the heck? Yeah. There you go. All right, so let me jump back over to my deck then. And look at how do we actually go build these things, right? So there is an Azure SDK. You can download it from the Azure.com website, go to the downloads, and there's downloads for different platforms and things like that. I'm a VS guy, so there's links off to the different versions of Visual Studio. The Azure SDK actually has a whole bunch of just functionality that's not specific to Visual Studio, but these downloads include additional tooling to help Visual Studio have project templates that work with the different kinds of cloud services, as well as to help you manage your deployments. And you know, you saw web deploy right up to an Azure website from Visual Studio earlier, and the attaching debuggers. That's all stuff that you get by installing the Azure SDK. Inside Visual Studio then, like I said, you get a whole bunch of new project templates and things like that. And you'll see in your file new project, this cloud category. That gives you the ability to create cloud services, web apps, web jobs. You saw some of that in the previous demos out there as well. And there's now these new quick starts as well that even give you sort of starter projects that you can use for a bunch of different types of services out there. So pretty cool. Take a look at them, play around with them. When you create a cloud service project in Visual Studio, the project is kind of like that web or that cloud service I just built. It's just a container. It's just configuration and metadata. That's all that really goes into the cloud service project itself. Your actual code for your web roles and worker roles are going to go off in other projects. And so you can add one or more web role projects and one or more worker role projects. And your web role projects are just ASP.NET projects. They just have some additional references and classes, and we'll talk about that coming up. Your worker roles are just class library projects, again, with some additional references and that kind of stuff. So when you add a web role, you get a pick, you know, is this an ASP.NET, is it MVC or web forms or web API unit tests, you know, just, it looks just like the regular file new project that you would see for a web app. But when you actually do that, then you're going to get a cloud service project in your solution that has some configuration files, and then a separate project for each of the roles that you're going to create, web roles or worker roles, whatever they happen to be. And those role projects, again, are just regular projects with some additional references, and then each of them will have a special class. For example, with an ASP.NET project, I'll have a webrole.cs, or for worker role, I'll get a worker role.cs, and they're role entry point implementations. We'll talk about that coming right up here as well. So these are the additional references. You'll notice, for example, here on the slide, the screenshot there, I've got a web role, and then under the references, there's additional references that you wouldn't normally see in a regular web project off to the Windows Azure configuration, diagnostics, service runtime, and storage libraries. And that's going to let you work with storage and get to the configuration settings that are in the metadata, talk to the service runtime and say, hey, what are all the other role instances and what are those input endpoints and internal endpoints and all that good stuff. Being able to query and find out about the execution environment where you're running, as well as to do diagnostic logging and that kind of stuff. So inside each of those projects, inside the WebRoll project, you'll have an additional class that gets added called WebRoll.cs by default. Your worker role projects by default have a worker role.cs. And those guys implement this role entry point class, which is part of the Azure SDKs. It's part of what the runtime actually calls into is it's spinning up your roles or an instance of your role. And so it'll actually call into this class and say, hey, class, I'm starting you. So there's an onStart method in which you can write any startup logic that you have to run, right? So that is, as an example, we talked about startup scripts. And I said you might have to do some things with elevated privileges. You have to do that in startup scripts. Yeah. But the onStart would let you do other things that you want to do programmatically that maybe don't require elevated permissions or that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Any framework, any type of initialization setup, that's usually what I'm doing in onStart, yep. Especially if I'm doing something with, code first. Not migrations as much as this initialization logic. I like to do an onStart before we actually get the service running, just to give me a little bit of a jump.
Yeah. Yeah. Similarly, when your role is being shut down nicely, it'll call the onStop for you, and you can do any cleanup code in there. And then there's also a run method that for web roles, you don't really need it because IIS already knows how to go run your website for you. But with a worker role, run is its whole point in life, is it's going to go do something inside run, right, and implement whatever your backend logic is.
And just to jump in there, it's very important that you go to MSDN and read the articles on the role entry point class, because onStart and run and onStop have really unique behaviors. I believe it's the default implementation for run is just to block indefinitely. So when you have the difference to a web role and a worker role is that the web role has the IIS self-hosted module installed. Well, if you implement your own run method, you need to block indefinitely, especially if it's a web role. If you return from the run method, it's going to recycle your web or worker role, which is bad. If you go in, I think onStart, it expects you to return a Boolean. If you return a false, mm-hmm. It lets the ecosystem know that something failed during initialization and won't try again. So if you see weird things like your role constantly recycling, go look at your role entry point class. It's usually where it is.
Yep, good stuff. So if you actually go up and look at the cloud service project then, the cloud service project is really just the configuration. It's what are my roles? What code am I going to run on those roles? What endpoints do we need? What settings do those roles need? Are there certificates or diagnostics configurations? It's all metadata. So your cloud service project is really a collection of XML files. And there's a service definition file, which is actually part of the deployed package. And it's what's used by that fabric controller to set up your execution environment. If you change anything in service definition, you have to redeploy.
Yep.
So it's a bigger task, right? Your service configuration, however, has more sort of runtime settings. How many instances of these roles do you want? For any settings that you specified, what are the actual setting values? So you can change those at runtime. Certificates, so you can swap out certificates without having to redeploy, some other stuff like that. Those go inside your configuration file. And there's actually two versions of the configuration file. There's a cloud version and a local version, which by default, the local version is what gets used when I'm debugging locally, and the cloud version gets used when I'm actually deploy up to the cloud. You can create additional ones if you want to for different reasons, and when you deploy, you actually get to tell it which configuration file do you want to use as you actually ship up to it there.
And it's important to think of it the same way you think of web deploy packages. Whereas we talked about web deploy packages where I hand a package off to my administrator and they actually do the deployment. With the cloud services, you can hand off a cloud service package to your administrator and it comes with that configuration file. So if your administrator has access to your production Azure account and you don't want your devs or your test team to have access to that account, your administrator can get your cloud service package, I think Brett's going to jump into this, and the configuration file and change the values. So that when they do their deployment, they don't have to reveal their production storage account credentials or DB credentials to you.
Yep, Indeed, yeah. And the last thing I'll mention from that SDK is that you actually get a compute and a storage emulator. And the compute emulator lets you debug your WebRoll and WorkerRoll instances locally in your dev box without actually having to deploy up to Azure. And the storage emulator emulates the tables, queues, and blobs from the storage service. And Sydney will talk about that later on as well. And you can run those yourself from the command line, but Visual Studio knows about them, can spawn them, and help you, you know, automatically deploy your code into them and all that good stuff. So let me jump back over and look at developing cloud services. Oops, sorry. So I'll go back over to my demo box here. And inside Visual Studio, from File, New, Project. By the way, I'm using the new Community Edition of Visual Studio. Pretty nice. Free version of Visual Studio for anybody to use. But if I come down to Cloud, I can see I've got the Azure SDK installed. And here's Azure Cloud Service. And so I'll come out and let's stick this in the Module 2 folder. Actually, browse out to that. And I'll just call it something creative like My Cloud Service. Beautiful name, right?
So, Brett, while you're naming that, these are files that are going to be available to the students to download later. That's what I was just told. We have a hyperlink that I wanted to share with you real quick. Let me do it right here. I have a slide that just popped up. This is the hyperlink if you want to download the demos that Brett's doing. We're just sharing with you right now. It's a little bit easier for you to just go ahead and download it so you can follow along with his demos.
Yeah. And that I'm sure, will be in the chat window as well there. So anyhow, so and this file I'm creating new. So this won't be in the demo files, but it's just a blank project here, My Cloud Service. It's an Azure Cloud Service. I'm not going to worry about source control, but you can do source control integration and continuous deployment and that good stuff here as well. And I'll go ahead and say OK, and you'll notice that it's going to come back and ask me, OK, great, we know you want a cloud service. What are you going to put into it? What are the different roles that you want to have? And we've got some built-in project templates for web roles and worker roles. So I could say, you know, just give me a good old ASP.NET web role. And it's actually going to add a new project, and it's coming up with a project name of Web Role 1. That's not very good. So I didn't mean to hit space there. I can hit the pencil here and give it a better name, so I'll call it My Web Role. I don't know if that's any better, but okay.
Yeah, it is better.
And then I've got a worker role, so I'll go ahead and add that in here as well.
My worker role?
Yeah.
There we go.
You're catching on. My worker role.
Creative naming.
All right, so I've got my cloud service, and then I've got my web role and my worker role inside my cloud service. So I'll go ahead and say okay. And so it's now actually going out and spinning up all of those projects for me. For the web project, it says, what kind of web project do you want to be? And I'll just do MVC, leave it all to default, go ahead and say okay. And let it churn through this here. And so remember I said those web role and worker role projects are normal ASP.NET web projects or class library projects in the case of a worker role. It just adds in those four additional library references for the service runtime, configuration, diagnostics, and storage. And then it adds that role entry point class implementation for you. Otherwise, it's just the projects that you've been used to working with out there.
So some homework for you real quick. A real fun thing to do is to take the project definition file. You can go customize it and add in there's this XML attribute called on role type. You specify either worker role. And if you add that in, then you'll be able to add it in as a worker role to your project. That's literally the single difference.
Very cool. All right, so here's my Solution Explorer. And you can see my cloud service project, my web role project, and my worker role project. The worker role project is just really a class library. Notice it's just got a single class in it, worker role, and it implements that role entry point that I talked about. And notice that there's that run method. There's also the on start, and I don't think they give me an override. Oh, they do. There's an override for on stop as well. So in the case of the worker role, they go ahead and implement all of those, and there's some default code that's in there. And you'll notice that if I come back here and look at run, it goes out and does some tracing. We talked about that earlier. And then it just calls this run async method. And the run async just enters this loop, basically, that's going to go on forever. And so Sydney was talking about, you know, blocking it, making sure that run doesn't exit. So this is just going to sit there and loop and loop and loop until we either shut it down or tell it to cancel. And it, in this case, it just loops and says, I'm working, and then sleeps for a second, and then loops again and loops again, right? So this is kind of where you would go write whatever it is you want to do. Or you could include an XE and spawn a process and just tell it to wait until that process exits before you continue on. So if you want to ship up a pre-built executable as part of your package, write your startup script to install it if you need to. Run can basically just shell out and call that XE and then just sit and wait for it to come back here on you. All right, so let me take a different project, and these are in the demo file. So I'm going to come down here and open up a project that I've already got. And this is from a sample. And in fact, in the links, if you grab the demo files that Sydney was mentioning, there's a link off to where this sample came from. But anyhow, I'm going to pull up my completed version of this. And so this is basically a sample ads application, and it's going to let you post ads, you know, free stuff or cars or whatever, right? Think of it as a you know, a community classified ads, okay, you know, type website thing. And so I've got my cloud project, I've got a web role and a worker role, and then I've got this common class out here that has my data model for an ad, right? So an ad is going to know what its type is or its category. Is it cars, real estate, or free stuff? And then the ad has an ID, a title, a price, a description, the image URL, a thumbnail URL, and then the date that it was posted and the phone number and category, right? So that's sort of the data model for this. And what this app is going to do is use a web role to basically take in the ad and allow you to post up the image that you're going to associate. You know, you're selling a car, you want a picture of the car. But to actually display that, we want to have a thumbnail image of that. And so this is where the worker role comes in handy. Rather than having the website spend the time to actually do the processing of all those images, we can just stick the images off somewhere else. Remember this stateless thing? We don't want to stick it on the machine, we want to stick it off somewhere else. So in this sample, we're sticking it off into blob storage. And Sydney will talk about more about storage services later on. But we stick the big picture out in blob storage, and now we need something else to come around and know there's a new picture and to create the thumbnail for it, and then to update the record in the database that points off to the thumbnail image. So that's what my worker role is going to do. The worker role is going to be responsible for going through and basically finding those new messages or the new ads. And it's going to do that based on a queue. It'll look in a queue. It'll see a message that says, hey, there's a new image to be processed. It'll go find that image, process it, and stick it back up into storage. So you'll notice that we've got references off to my storage queues and blob services out here. And it looks like I need to do a build. Let me go do that really quick. Let it pull my NuGet packages back up here. All right. And so there's a few things in here. Let me, first of all, if I come down and look at, is it on start? Actually, back up to the top here really quick. You'll notice that I have some variables here. One that's going to help me find the queue that we document new images in, and the blob container where the actual images live. And then we've got an entity framework database context that the ads are actually going to be stored in. That'll be off in Azure SQL, which is kind of cool. So when this thing starts, if I come down to on start, we actually go in and get a connection string up to the database. So that now we know where our Azure SQL database is. We get a connection string up to our storage account and can point off to our blob container, as well as get a reference off to the queue, this images queue where we're going to store image messages in here. And again, I'm not trying to get too deep into storage. Sydney will come back and talk about these a little bit later on here. And then basically inside the run method, this guy is basically going to go in and read a message from the queue. Say, hey, Q, go get a message. And if it gets a message, that basically means there's a new image to process. It'll then come out and process that message. And what that's going to do is basically pull out from the message the ID of the ad that it needs to find. It's then going to go into there, find the ad, and retrieve the blob that has the photo. And then eventually down here, it'll go in and process the image. Where is that at? Convert image to thumbnail. And then generates the actual thumbnail and writes that back up to blob storage and updates the data record here for me. So I've got this relatively real-world sort of sample here. And if I go into the properties on my cloud service and go into the web page, I can see that this guy is going to use what's called the full emulator. Actually, by default, these guys use the Express emulator. And the Express emulator only lets you run a single instance of each role. But you don't require administrative privileges to run. The full emulator will actually let you run multiple instances, but you have to run Visual Studio as administrator. And you'll notice in my taskbar, or the title bar for my window up here, you can see my Visual Studio is running as admin. And that's just, you know, when you go in to run it, you know, run as administrator and make sure that you come in with those privileges. If you don't have administrative access, the Express emulator is great. You can just only run a single instance. So how do I tell it I want more than one instance? Well, that's actually part of this configuration. And you'll notice I have these XML files. And XML is great, but it's very case and syntax sensitive and all that kind of stuff. Aww. So rather than typing into the XML yourself, the roles node up here gives you visual editors for the configuration in those XML files, yeah, right? So that you can point and click and it'll help you type things in correctly here.
I like XML.
Yeah, well, XML is great. I'm just telling you what the other ones are for. So if I double click on the web node, for example, it'll open up the properties editor for that. And I can see, for example, here, I can simply say, hey, you want two instances? Do you want one instance? Do you want five instances? Whatever. And it makes it really easy for me to edit that, right? Let me knock it back down to two and I'll hit save. And I can actually now go debug this guy. And by the way, while I was doing that, it really was just coming in and editing these XML files. There's my instance count too, right? So it's just editing that. And here's all these other settings. And again, definitely read up on these settings. There's a lot of them. And make sure for the exam, if you're looking at taking that, that you're aware of what they all are, right? But I can now run this, and it's going to actually run it in the debugger down here locally. So it's spinning up my storage emulator for me. And down here in my system tray, you get this icon. It looks like a little Windows logo. So it's spinning up the compute emulator now. And you can right-click on this guy and tell it to show you the compute or storage emulator UIs. Sorry, try that again. As well as to shut down the emulators if you have to. But let me go spin up the compute emulator UI. And this is kind of like your view behind the curtain. You can kind of peek in here and see what's going on. So here I can see that we've deployed our cloud service. So here's the Contoso Ads cloud service. If I look at the web role, here's my two instances, and I can actually view their trace output. So these black or white on black windows look kind of like console windows. They're not, they're trace output. But you can view the trace output for each of your instances that are in there. And I can see that it was calling on start and that it was calling run. Here, same thing up here, I can see, these are actually trace information messages that are being streamed out here for me, and I can see that I'm creating my blob queues and or blob containers and image queues and all that. And so here's the actual website running. Sorry, it says new version. That's ignore that for a second. I can also do things like query the runtime and have it tell me things like, hey, what's my instance ID and all that kind of stuff. And for the code for that, if I actually jump over here and look inside the CS for my home controller. This is kind of where I can go out and ask that role environment that's part of that service runtime API and say, hey, tell me about my instance. And then from there, get me my ID or what's the name of the role that I'm running on. Or there's other things that you can pull off of that, right? And so in my case, I'm just surfacing that up on the page here so you could see that come back. But if I go into all, this is going to go query the database. And in this case, it's using LocalDB, which is a sort of a local user version of SQL Server, if you will. Give it a second here to spin up the data. This is using Entity Framework code first models. So it's looking at that and go, we don't have the ads table yet. So it's provisioning the ads table inside the database and all that. So it takes a little bit of time the first time you hit it. I'm running the done one. So I'm actually now pointing up at production. Sorry, I'd forgotten in the script. This is actually pointing at Azure. So this is really pointing at an Azure SQL database. And pulling those back, and it's actually pointing at an Azure storage account. I'd forgotten that in my script. I'll show you where that stuff is coming up here. But basically, here's my ads. I can come in and create a new ad. I'll create an ad for some pink stuff. It's free. It's pink. Browse out and find an image file. So here's a pink file I can open up. I'm going to stick this off in free stuff, my phone number. Please don't call me. I'm busy right now. So 1212, there we go. Create it. And so now it's actually sticking the row in the database, writing a message off to queue, and then the worker role is eventually going to come back and read the queue and go, there's a new image to process. And so I can actually see that stuff back over here in those trace output windows. So it looks like this instance is the one that I actually hit it in. So it created the ad ID in the database and created the queue message. And then the worker role I should see, hopefully here, we'll eventually, did it not get it yet? Still hasn't processed? Let's see if it actually did. So I can refresh here. Nope, still hasn't processed. I don't know why my worker role isn't kicking off for me. This is demo gremlins kicking in here, right?
No, is this the point where you blame latency?
No, this is preview software. No, sorry. Yeah, I don't know why my worker role isn't kicking off for me there. No, that's interesting.
So one of the good things about debugging everything locally and running it in the emulator is that you can go in and attach a breakpoint.
Yep.
So this is the best place to find if something's off. I mean, you can still do this when you actually deploy it to Azure, but this is your way of doing it locally without incurring billing. And this is where you learn about your application. You do things like if you have multiple instances of your worker role, see what happens if a worker role goes down. Does it self-heal? Does from your application design perspective,
yep. You know,
are you handling the queue correctly?
Yeah, so now I've actually already deployed this up into the cloud as prep for this module. And so my guess is it's actually the running copy of the queue reader worker role that actually processed this, because I never saw any output. This guy almost feels like he's frozen. I don't know what's going on there. But yet I still miraculously somehow got my pink thumbnail to show up, and that's probably because the one in Azure actually went and processed it for me. We'll see that coming up. But that's the project structure and that kind of stuff, how you get in. Notice I can debug locally. We've got these emulators and that kind of stuff. So let me jump back to the deck again and look at deploying, right? So now that you have this project, we can now take that, and just like you saw Sydney publish the website, we can also publish our cloud services up into Azure here. So I can basically, when I do that, in fact, when you go in to your project, you can, instead of doing a publish, you can also do a package that just builds the deployment package but doesn't actually ship it up. And that package file is going to be a CSPKG file. It's really just a zip file. If you renamed it to zip, you could open it up and see what's inside of it. There's also a command line tool that you can use to build that, right? It's called CSPack. It's part of the Azure command line tools. It's also going to get a copy of the service configuration file, whatever you specify, the cloud one or the local one or whatever else it is, my admin one if somebody else has a different version of it there. So the definition file is part of the package. The configuration file is external to the package, right? I can then think of that data center, right? And inside the data center, I had my cloud service with that cloud app.net or net name. Inside there, we actually have what are called deployment slots. So we saw that with websites, with cloud services, you only have two, production and staging, but you're going to have to know which one you want to push up to, and then it's into that deployment slot that we're actually going to go spin up the web role instances and all that kind of stuff. So I now need to get that package pushed up into that deployment slot. And so there's another command line tool called CS Upload that can help you actually deploy that package. But from Visual Studio, I just say publish, and it takes care of that whole workflow for me, right? So that's nice about using VS instead of command line tools and all that kind of stuff.
And you can do it in a current portal too. You can actually go in and there's a UI that says, what is your package? What is your configuration file?
Yep.
Done.
Yep. So you can all, deploy it from the portal as well there. So, or script it again. Yep.
Script it.
So, and then the Fabric controller gets your package and takes care of actually spinning up your instances and setting up the endpoints and all that good stuff. Right?
Wouldn't the world be nicer if we script everything?
Yeah. So if you look at those deployment slots, production and staging, right, you get two of them on any given cloud service. Be aware that these are two totally redundant environments. So if you deploy to both, you're paying for the resources in both. If you've gone from staging to production and you no longer need staging, delete those resources so you're not paying for them. But I've got a production slot and a staging slot. The production slot is the one that has that cloud service name.cloudapp.net name on it. And so that's usually what your regular customers are seeing. And that's where your normal production web role instances and all that kind of stuff would be. Your staging slot, you can also deploy up to. It's going to get a GUID-based .cloudapp.net name. And that GUID is really your service ID, right, behind the scenes there. But the only people that would ever hit that are people that you've shared that GUID URL with, right? People aren't going to accidentally stumble across that unless you publish it somewhere. So this is one of those things you say, okay, we have new version of code that we are ready to deploy. It's just not verified that it's really working in production yet. So you can push it up to staging, do your last minute checks, does this all look good? And then if it does, you can do what's called a VIP swap or a VIP swap. And a VIP swap basically is just gonna say, hey, the IP address that belonged to cloud app or production is now on staging and vice versa. So it really just swaps those names and IP addresses to point to those other slots. So what used to be production is now staging, and what used to be staging is now production, right? So you've just swapped them. The cool thing is once you get that over there, if you go, whoa, that's wrong, you can just VIP swap right back again, right?
Yep.
So a really easy way to recover from that. So Let me jump back over here, and in the interest of time, I won't make us sit and wait, because if I come over here to my project and I tell it that I want to deploy, notice, by the way, there was also, I'll show you this, there was a package option that says don't actually deploy it, just build the package.
Yep.
But publish is going to package and deploy, right? So I can jump in here, and this already has a profile loaded up, but notice that when I deploy, I can choose, am I trying to go to production or staging, right? And when you actually publish this, it's got to go spin up those virtual machines. This is going to take a lot longer than those website deployments that you saw Sydney do, because we actually have to go spin up all the instances, we've got to find the right base images, we've got to run your startup scripts, we've got to deploy your code.
Yep.
So these will take anywhere from probably 5 to 10 minutes, depending on the number of instances you have and that kind of stuff, before the cloud service is ready and able to respond. So I'm not going to sit here and watch that, but you hit publish and it'll kick off and go to the races here.
So Brett, real quick before you move on, somebody asked a question about the build configuration within that publish dialog. They say, you know, is there any special rules around that? Is there anything I need to consider? Or if I do the release build configuration or debug build configuration, is there any standards or rules to what slot?
Well, normally if you're going to predict, well, staging is production, just not yet.
Yep.
Staging is not QA. Staging is not a test environment. It is a pre-production environment. So don't ever think of staging as QA, right? This is production almost, right? It's just minutes away from being production. It's that thing of, boy, I want to deploy, but I hate to overwrite what I have in case there's a problem. Right, so staging gives you that two-stage deployment mechanism. You can deploy staging and flip. So you normally, in those environments, want to deploy a release build. Only if you're thinking about attaching a debugger do you want to do a debug build, and that'll include the debug symbols and all that other kind of stuff. But if you're not planning on doing debugging against that deployment, which production you wouldn't normally want to do, but maybe
right.
This is a dev deployment, you can also build deployments around these, right? So, and that's where you're not going to be deploying right from VS. You would
right.
be deploying through a build system or something like that. So, all right. So if I come to my the actual running version of this site, I've already published it up. And you'll notice if I go to the dashboard, I actually have two views. There's the production view and the staging view, right? And this guy actually has a public name. It's this MVA 532 contosoads.cloudapp.net. Let me open that up in a new tab here. So this is a cloud-based. This is the same project I just had locally and running locally in the emulator. It's just now deployed up to Azure. We'll see those same. Remember I said I was already pointing at the live databases and storage accounts and all that kind of stuff. So this should have my pink stuff already in it because it's the same data. So there's the pink stuff. That's good. However, let's say that I've built a new version. Remember my code in here on my home view, I had updated the view to say new version, right? So I added this text. And if I look at the current deployment and I go back to the home page, this doesn't say new version. Well, I've actually already deployed the new version off to staging. So I can now go look at the staging site and notice that it has a different URL, right? And again, you'd get this URL if you had just done the deployment and waited long enough on it. But I'm gonna come in and just open that up in a new tab. And you'll notice that this looks just like the original home page. However, it has the new version in it, right? And so I can point users either at the normal URL or at the GUID-based URL, and they can see the two different versions. And when I decide this looks good, I'm ready to go ahead and deploy, I can now come in and swap. And it's gonna do that VIP swap and basically just turn production into staging and staging into production. So I'll go ahead and hit OK on that. Shouldn't take too long.
And a big focus here is the minimized downtime. The idea
yep.
here is that if you would actually redeploy to production, we would have significant downtime. So swapping the VIPs is just a logical way of handling that scenario. Almost ingenious.
Yep. And it's really cool. And websites, again, it's similar to that staging slots, although with websites, you get more than two slots. You can add as many as you want. With cloud services, you just get the two. All right, and of course it knows that I'm watching this, so it's trying to take longer than it normally does here for me, but let's see if it's actually already swapped. Demo Gremlins, come on. There it is. So notice now I'm on the MVA 532 Contoso ads, and I have the new version deployed. And if I go to the GUID-based one and refresh, I should have the old version.
All right.
Back up there again, right? So I can VIP swap back and forth if need be. All right. So that's deployments. Let me jump up and I'll just hit the last stuff here really quick on monitoring, right? So you actually kind of saw this already, you know, the adding in trace diagnostics and that kind of stuff, performance counters, et cetera, those are all things that are pretty important to monitoring a production environment, but they're also really important during debug. So you want to implement this stuff sooner than later. You saw in the portal that I actually had sort of performance counters and things like that that you can monitor within there. We'll see that again coming up in just a second. And in fact, on the monitor tab, you can even sort of choose what performance counters you want to see, et cetera. But probably a more robust way to monitor that is to track this stuff into some data store that you can then go in and report on. So we actually have a very robust diagnostics configuration that you can set up. And there's a diagnostics monitoring agent that runs in your role instances, can gather this data together from each instance, and then transfer that data over to an Azure storage table where you then can come read it. Programmatically. And there's a number of third-party tools that you can go get to help you process that data because it's all in an understood format, et cetera, there. And so you can actually configure that stuff, again, in some XML config files, or Visual Studio can help you set those up. Based off of those same performance settings, you can also do auto-scale, same stuff that Sydney talked about earlier. Although you'll notice that with cloud services, I have CPUs as well as queue length. And in this case, we're talking about an Azure storage queue. I can actually go look at that queue and say, hey, we're getting more than 50 messages about new ads that need to have thumbnails generated, and my one worker role just isn't clicking or keeping up. So I could say, hey, and it's when that queue gets to a certain depth that I want you to scale up the number of worker role instances so that they can have multiple ones processing that back in for me. So let me jump back over and just do one quick last piece over here. If I look at my code, my configuration, under my roles, you can actually see there were two other additional XML-based files in there. And these are the diagnostics collection configuration for each of those guys. And so again, yes, you could edit the XML, or if I just go into my roles properties, there's this handy little enable diagnostics configure. You can tell it which storage account you want to go store those diagnostics values off into, and then go through each of these tabs and tell it what is it you want to capture, performance counters and all that good stuff. And that monitoring agent will use this configuration to gather that data, transfer it off to either tables or blobs in the storage account that you specify, and go for it, right? So if I actually come back over to Visual Studio, you see that mine is going to this MVA 532 Diags. Inside Visual Studio, I can go to my Server Explorer, drill into my storage. Here's my MVA 532 Diag storage account. And when I come down to tables, you can actually see these WAD diagnostics. So that's Windows Azure Diagnostics, Diagnostic Infrastructure Logs, Tables, Counters, whatever, Event Logs. Let me open up the Performance Counters one so I can just right-click on that and say View Table. And you'll notice that this is actually a bunch of different performance counters. So applications, errors, queued, rejected, megabytes, memory available. It's all these performance counters being captured and the actual numbers associated with them, the date and time they were associated at. So I can now pull this into a log reader or some tool to help me process that data and actually visualize this or even act on it, start to drive alerts off this data or something else. All right. So even trying to talk like a speed demon here, I still went over on time, but hopefully that gave you, again, some good understanding of sort of what cloud services are, how web roles and worker roles are maybe different from websites and virtual machines, how the basic process for going and developing, deploying them, monitoring, and all that good stuff. So
yeah.
Any other thoughts on that?
There's a couple of questions that came up about, when will you choose websites over cloud services? The answer is, it really depends on your application. I like to think of websites as like almost no friction option for deploying web applications. Cloud services is a very high friction option, but the level of control you get, the level of transparency, you saw the diagnostics configuration, mm-hmm. you saw the other configuration options, you just have such a deep level of control that you can architect really, truly scalable and resilient solutions that you can still do with Azure websites. But Azure Cloud Services really lets you focus on your code and don't worry about the infrastructure for that. They have the infrastructure handled. You do infrastructure through configuration.
Yeah, I'll go back to the way I said it before. The way I think of it is if I'm going to start a new project, assuming it's a web-based project, the answer is Azure websites. until I hit some technical barrier that I can't do. Like, I had to have this VB6 COM DLL stuck in some directory and registered with this batch file and RegsSVR32 or whatever. I can't do that on a website, right? And so that's where I want startup scripts and that kind of configuration ability that I have in cloud services with wearables and worker roles. But I still don't want to manage VMs until I have to. And until now, you need some very specific, or the other big difference, stateless versus stateful. Web roles and worker roles and websites, that your nodes are stateless versus infrastructure nodes, they're stateful, right? So when you have something stateful, like SQL Server, you want your own SQL Server installation, you have to do that in an IaaS VM. You can't do it in a web role, worker role, you can't do it in a website, right? So when you have a stateful workload or one that requires complex configuration, go with IaaS. Otherwise, websites, if it's not that, then it's cloud services. If it's not that, then you're back down to IaaS.
So I think we're going to take another 10-minute break, and then we're going to come back with the most scary option for developers of virtual machines. We'll introduce virtual machines at a very high level. I mean, it's not too much on it in exam OD, but I'll give you enough to be dangerous. So we'll go talk about that and look forward to seeing you in another 10 minutes.
All right, thanks.